Mark's time comprised only one element in explaining the subsequent trajectory of the country. I doubt that Hayek would deny this. If he did, he would certainly be on very shaky ground. Nonetheless, if this part of his thesis seems overstated, it is only fair to recall the original structure of Hayek's argument. The road to serfdom was intended to be the final section of a much larger project, in which Hayek would trace the gradual decline of liberalism in a number of different countries. Hayek's specific arguments about Germany make much more sense within the context of this larger project. His decision to publish as a separate piece the conclusion of his work is akin to offering a punchline without the joke. We must also remember the sorts of arguments he was trying to confront with his thesis. As Hayek frequently repeated, many intelligent and informed people of his day had been taken in by the claim that National Socialism was the next logical and historical phase of a collapsing capitalism. His point, one that most would accept today as evident, was that fascism and communism both represent totalitarian systems that have much more in common with each other than either does with the sorts of governments and economic systems that exist under liberal free market democracies. The Nazis demonized and persecuted the communists, to be sure, but it was not because they were themselves capitalists. Hayek simply sought to establish the true commonalities. Another oft-voiced complaint was that Hayek's book was long on criticism, but short on or vague concerning proposed alternatives. After 10 years of economic depression, many people felt that capitalism had finally breathed its last and that something new had to replace it. What was Hayek offering? Writing in the New Republic, Alvin Hansen noted that Hayek distinguished in his book between good planning and bad planning, then asked Hayek to inform his readers precisely how he would draw the line between the two. John Maynard Keynes read the book on the way to the Bretton Woods Conference and delighted Hayek when he wrote him that it was a grand book and that, morally and philosophically, I find myself in agreement with virtually the whole of it, and not only in agreement with it, but in a deeply moved agreement. Keynes went on to say, though, that you admit here and there that it is a question of knowing where to draw the line. You agree that the line has to be drawn somewhere, and that the logical extreme is not possible. But you give us no guidance whatever as to where to draw it. Hayek evidently took these criticisms to heart, for in the coming years, he would make two further important contributions to political philosophy that would refine and extend the arguments made in The Road to Serfdom. In The Constitution of Liberty, he laid out the philosophical foundations of liberal constitutionalism, wherein a private sphere of individual activity is defined, the state is granted a monopoly on coercion, and then is constitutionally limited by the rule of law in its use of those coercive powers. In the last third of the book, Hayek outlined the specific sorts of government policies that were consistent with such a political setup. In Law, Legislation, and Liberty, Hayek lamented how Western democracies were increasingly circumventing the spirit of liberal constitutionalism by passing coercive legislation, typically under the guise of achieving social justice, but in reality serving well-organized coalitions of special interests. The book also included a unique proposal for legislative reform aimed at establishing the ideal of a constitutionally constrained liberal democratic commonwealth. A third complaint is that Hayek's argument against socialism in The Road to Serfdom is unconvincing because, by failing to address market socialism, it must be viewed as incomplete. Evan Durbin, Hayek's old sparring partner at the LSE, was one of the first to enunciate the argument, chiding Hayek in his review in the Economic Journal for making only one reference to the work of those of us who are both practicing economists and also socialists, and that in a footnote, thereby neglecting all recent writings on the subject. According to Durbin, democratic socialism need not imply any rigid program of production, but only that the final responsibility for taking economic decisions is transferred from the private company or group of shareholders to the representatives of the community. Durbin's democratic socialism was a variant of the market socialism, sometimes also referred to by Hayek as competitive socialism, that Oscar Lange had articulated in On the Economic Theory of Socialism. As was noted earlier, Hayek had already criticized this doctrine in a review of the Lange volume published in 1940. It was to this review that Hayek referred in his long note on market socialism in The Road to Serfdom. Market socialism may sound like an oxymoron, but it is a position that has seldom failed to intrigue economists seeking the middle way. Market socialists are critics of capitalism, to be sure, but they accept as a starting premise that perfectly competitive markets have certain desirable efficiency characteristics. Crucially, however, they deny that any real-world markets resemble those described under perfect competition. The days of atomistic competition disappeared when cartels and monopolies began emerging in the late 19th century. Contemporary capitalism, then, lacks the beneficial aspects of competition, while retaining all of its defects. A planned market socialist economy would restore true competition with all of its benefits, while simultaneously correcting the myriad social injustices associated with unfettered capitalism. In Lange's specific blueprint for a market socialist society, there exist free markets for both consumer goods and labor, but, because of public ownership of the means of production, no market for productive resources. A central planning board would provide prices, adjusting them up or down, using a trial-and-error method, depending on revealed shortages or surpluses. Market socialism is attractive because it seems to combine the best parts of rival systems, the efficiency of a market-based system, and egalitarian policies aimed at promoting social justice, all combined within a democratic polity. In his review, Hayek raised a number of pertinent questions about the details of Lange's plan, most of which suggested that, though market socialism sounded good, it would not work. One of his key complaints was that Lange had neglected to say how often prices would need to be adjusted in his proposed system. This was an important issue, for even with relatively quick adjustments, something that Hayek thought would be difficult to sustain, Hayek maintained that an extensive system of price fixing would still always be playing catch-up relative to the adjustments that would take place in a market system, and so would be less efficient. In making his points, Hayek wrote famously that it is difficult to suppress the suspicion that this particular proposal has been born out of an excessive preoccupation with problems of the pure theory of stationary equilibrium. Hayek's later and much fuller development of how markets work to coordinate social and economic activity in a world in which knowledge is dispersed, a world very different from that described by the theory of stationary equilibrium, would become one of his central contributions to economics. Hayek then had already articulated a set of arguments against market socialism. Why did he relegate them to a note in The Road to Serfdom? One clue is given by a letter that Lange wrote to Hayek on July 31, 1940, in which he responded to Hayek's review and tried to clear up a misunderstanding. I do not propose price fixing by a real central planning board as a practical solution. It was used in my paper only as a methodological device to show how equilibrium prices can be determined by trial and error, even in the absence of a market in the institutional sense of the word. Practically, I should, of course, recommend the determination of the prices by a thorough market process, whenever this is feasible. Hayek might be forgiven if he were to infer from this letter that Lange had basically accepted his criticisms about the practical feasibility of market socialism. Though obviously Durbin thought differently, Hayek felt that market socialism was little more than an interesting theoretical exercise, the sort of thing that economists like to play with on the blackboard, but not something to be taken seriously as practical proposal. But even more to the point, Hayek did not write The Road to Serfdom chiefly with theoretical economists like Lange or Durbin in mind. Unlike such economists, most advocates of planning had not even begun to think through what it meant to have a planned society. For them, planning itself was, as Robbins had put it, a panacea. It was this vague but widespread sentiment for which the road to serfdom was meant to be an antidote. Hayek was trying to show his readers that planning, everyone's favorite remedy for the ills of the world, might sound good in theory, but would not work in practice, or at least, not unless the Western democracies were prepared to accept severe constraints on personal liberty of the sort on display in the systems against which they currently were fighting. This explains, I think, why Hayek did not bother to lay out the argument against market socialism in his book. He felt that market socialism was only a theoretical dream, and that the details of the argument against it would be out of place in a general book. His economist readers, he doubtless presumed, were already aware of the arguments he had made in 1940, arguments he felt had succeeded. If they weren't, he reminded them with a note. As such, one could understand that Hayek felt a bit miffed by Durbin's insinuation that he had neglected all the recent work. His irritation is evident in the unpublished version of his 1948 postscript. Mr. Durbin is especially pained that I have not taken more seriously and devoted no more than a note to the interesting schemes of a competitive socialism which have been put forward in recent years in a number of learned books and articles. I am quite ready to discuss their theoretical merits, and have in fact done so at some length in an article quoted in the footnote just referred to. And I shall be very glad to examine these plans further as soon as there are any signs that they are taken seriously by, and exercise any practical influence on, the politics of the socialist parties. But I have yet to find any socialist party which is willing even to consider using competition as the method for organizing economic activity. And until this is the case, I cannot see that anyone but the specialist need be bothered with the objections to those ingenious schemes. But I may perhaps be allowed to add that I should have more confidence in the genuineness of the desire to reconcile freedom and socialism by means of a competitive socialism if one of the main advocates of these schemes, Professor Oskar Lange, had not chosen to become one of the main spokesmen of the Russian point of view on the Council of the United Nations, and if Mr. Durbin were not now himself a member of the socialist British government, which is doing most of the things of which he apparently disapproves. Durbin would die in a drowning accident in 1948, which may explain why this passage was never included in the foreword. Alas, Lange's accommodation to the political realities in his native Poland would only increase through time. He went on to write apologetics for Stalin, and, renouncing his earlier views on market socialism, even went so far as to forbid their republication in Polish. Though Lange and Durbin are gone, the dreams for market socialism among economic theorists never seem to die, the most recent revival occurring after the collapse of the Soviet bloc in the last decade of the last century. Its longevity is easy to explain. For those who seek a middle way, market socialism is the ideal system. In more recent discussions, Hayek's original critique has been substantially bolstered by additional arguments, some from the economics of information that identify incentive problems, others from public choice analysis that identify political obstacles that would confront any such regime. But it is perhaps sufficient to say, as Hayek did in 1948, that until a real-world example of such an ingenious scheme is forthcoming, it is best considered a theoretical construct of interest only to specialists, one that has no particular relevance for the world in which we actually live. A final criticism has sometimes been called the inevitability thesis, or the slippery slope argument. Hayek is claimed to have said that once a society engages in a little planning, it is doomed to end up in a totalitarian state. Durbin was among those making this charge, writing that Hayek believed that any departure from the practice of free enterprise, any hope that reason and science may be applied to the direction of economic activity, any attempt at economic planning, must lead us remorselessly to serfdom. If Durbin's statement of the inevitability thesis seems unusually stark, He was certainly not alone in thinking that. Hayek had said that any expansion of state control over the economy would necessarily lead to a totalitarian outcome. Those who so interpreted him spanned the ideological spectrum, from Barbara Wooten to George Stigler. Paul Samuelson even expressed the idea diagrammatically in his Principles of Economics text, drawing political freedom on one axis, economic freedom on the other, and a movement down the curve, slippery slope indeed, from high to low levels of both being what Hayek supposedly predicted, that government modification of laissez-faire must lead inevitably to political serfdom. This interpretation occurred despite Hayek's frequent protests to the contrary. Sometimes he objected publicly, as he did in the preface to the 1976 edition. It has frequently been alleged that I have contended that any movement in the direction of socialism is bound to lead to totalitarianism. Even though this danger exists, this is not what the book says. In private, he could be both more forceful and explicit, as may be seen in his letter to Paul Samuelson. I am afraid in glancing through the 11th edition of your Economics, I seem to have discovered the source of the false allegation about my book, The Road to Serfdom, which I constantly encounter, most resent, and can only regard as a malicious distortion, which has largely succeeded in discrediting my argument. You assert that I contend that each step away from the market system and towards the social reform of the welfare state is inevitably a journey that must end in a totalitarian state, and that government modification of market laissez-faire must lead inevitably to political serfdom. How anyone who has read my book can in good faith say this, when ever since the first edition, I say right at the beginning, nor am I arguing that these developments are inevitable. If they were, there would be no point in writing this. They can be prevented if people realize in time where their efforts may lead. Given the ubiquity of the inevitability thesis interpretation among both his friends and his foes, as well as Hayek's own insistence that this was not his argument, it is important to try to figure out exactly what has given rise to the confusion. Hayek's letter to Samuelson allows us to rule out one way of interpreting the word inevitability. Hayek was decidedly not making the historical claim that no matter what future moves were made in Britain and America, there was no turning back, that a socialist future that would end in totalitarianism was inevitably coming. This kind of inevitability thesis was, after all, exactly what Hayek was criticizing in his essay, Scientism and the Study of Society. When he attacked historicism, the belief that there were historical laws, knowledge of which allowed one to predict a necessary future. A more plausible way to read Hayek's words is to see him as warning that unless we change our ways, we are headed down the road to serfdom. It was certainly part of Hayek's intent to issue such a warning. He was, in particular, afraid that we might embark on such a path without really realizing it, or as he put it in his speech before the Economic Club of Detroit, the danger is the greater because we may choose the wrong way, not by deliberation and concerted decision, but because we seem to be blundering into it. As the title of his fourth chapter makes clear, some of Hayek's opponents had made the claim that planning was inevitable, that unless we embraced planning for freedom, we were headed toward totalitarianism. Hayek presumably was hoping to stand such an argument on its head, to show that, rather than the only means of counteracting totalitarianism, planning itself constituted a significant step along the way toward the totalitarian state. Yet another way to read Hayek is to see him as offering a logical rather than a historical argument. Hayek recognized that liberal socialists value freedom of choice and the honoring of individual preferences. What he denied was that they could maintain those values and still carry out their proclaimed program of extensive central planning. As he succinctly put it, socialism can be put into practice only by methods which most socialists disapprove. Even if it were to begin as a liberal socialist experiment, none of the real-world cases have ever done so, one might add, Full-scale planning requires that the planning authorities take over all production decisions. To be able to make any decisions at all, they would need to exercise more and more political control. If one tries to create a truly planned society, one will not be able to separate out control of the economy from political control. This was Hayek's logical argument against planning, one that he had succinctly articulated in 1939 in Freedom and the Economic System. In the end, agreement that planning is necessary, together with the inability of the Democratic Assembly to agree on a particular plan, must strengthen the demand that the government, or some single individual, should be given powers to act on their own responsibility. It becomes more and more the accepted belief that, if one wants to get things done, the responsible director of affairs must be freed from the fetters of democratic procedure. Now, evidently, in the years since he wrote, the countries that Hayek was most concerned about, the Western European democracies and the United States, despite the rhetoric of their left-wing politicians, did not go to anything like complete central planning or full nationalization of the means of production. For example, though there was a movement in this direction in Britain directly after the war, it reached its high point by the late 1940s, and even then, only about 20% of British industry was nationalized. Those who see Hayek as issuing a prediction of an inevitable trend would view this history as refuting his claim. Those who see him as providing a warning might consider thanking him for saving them from disaster. If one confronts Hayek's logical argument, however, the subsequent paths of the Western European democracies are not really tests of Hayek's thesis. To be sure, many of them did develop substantial welfare states, and Hayek spoke about the separate dangers of these in his later writings. But the existence of such states, and whatever successes they may or may not have had, does not undermine Hayek's logical argument from the road to serfdom. A welfare state is not socialism. The proper way to evaluate Hayek's logical thesis is to ask, how many actually existing real-world political systems have fully nationalized their means of production and preserved both some measure of economic efficiency and freedom of choice over goods and occupations? Count them up. Then, compare the number with those that nationalized their means of production and turned to extensive planning and control, and with it, the curtailment of individual liberties. If one agrees that this is the right test, Hayek's position is fully vindicated. Full socialism can only be put into practice by using methods of which most socialists would disapprove. The continuing relevance of The Road to Serfdom. Reading, or perhaps rereading, The Road to Serfdom will be a pleasurable experience for some and induce apoplexy in others. It continues to be a lightning rod, as well as a Rorschach test, revealing as much about the reader's prior commitments as it does about Hayek's ideas. For younger readers, the book may also be a bit of a mystery, for though it has elements of a general treatise, more on which anon, it was also very much, as he himself once admitted, a tract for the times. Modern readers who are not familiar with the history of the Third Reich may stumble over names like Julius Streicher or Robert Ley. And who today still recalls Sir Richard Ackland's Forward March Movement or the Temporary National Economic Committee? As editor, I have tried to provide brief notes that place these individuals, groups, and ideas in context in an effort to make it easier for readers today to enter the world that Hayek inhabited. At the same time, the book is also filled with timeless ideas. Hayek's immediate objective was to persuade his British audience that their heritage of liberal democracy under the rule of law should be viewed as a national treasure rather than an object of scorn, as a still vital roadmap for organizing society rather than an embarrassing relic of times gone by. Though much depends on how one defines one's terms, his was a message that invites more than occasional re-examination. Another theme, evident perhaps more explicitly in this introduction than in specific passages in Hayek's own text, but nonetheless very much a part of his underlying motivation in writing the book, is Hayek's warning concerning the dangers that times of war pose for established civil societies. For it is during such times when hard-won civil liberties are most likely to be all too easily given up. Even more troubling, politicians instinctively recognize the seductive power of war. Times of national emergency permit the invocation of a common cause and a common purpose. War enables leaders to ask for sacrifices. It presents an enemy against which all segments of society may unite. This is true of real war. But because of its ability to unify disparate groups, savvy politicians from all parties find it effective to invoke war metaphors in a host of contexts. The war on drugs, the war on poverty, and the war on terror are but three examples from recent times. What makes these examples even more worrisome than true wars is that none has a logical endpoint. Each may be invoked forever. Hayek's message was to be wary of such martial invocations. His specific fear was that, for a war to be fought effectively, the power and size of the state must grow. No matter what rhetoric they employ, politicians and the bureaucracies over which they preside love power, and power is never easily surrendered once the danger, if there ever was one, has passed. Though eternal vigilance is sage advice, surely wartime, or when politicians would try to convince us that it is such a time, is when those who value the preservation of individual liberty must be most on guard. Finally, what one finds in this book, and in all of Hayek's work, is a clear recognition of the power of ideas. It was perhaps John Maynard Keynes who said it best in the closing chapter of The General Theory. The ideas of economists and political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Practical men, who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences, are usually the slaves of some defunct economist. Madmen in authority, who hear voices in the air, are distilling their frenzy from some academic scribbler of a few years back. I am sure that the power of vested interests is vastly exaggerated compared with the gradual encroachment of ideas. Hayek would have offered his immediate assent, adding, perhaps, that Keynes's passage carries with it the implication that those who fail to understand the origins of the ideas do so at their peril. Given the many years of his life that he spent diligently toiling, the perennial advocate of causes that most of his contemporaries thought of as lost, anachronistic, or a return to reaction, perhaps no person better represents the notion of the power of ideas in the 20th century than does F.A. Hayek. Bruce Caldwell. The Road to Serfdom. It is seldom that liberty of any kind is lost all at once. David Hume. I should have loved freedom, I believe, at all times, but in the time in which we live, I am ready to worship it. Alexis de Tocqueville. To the socialists of all parties. Preface to the original editions. When a professional student of social affairs writes a political book, his first duty is plainly to say so. This is a political book. I do not wish to disguise this by describing it, as I might perhaps have done, by the more elegant and ambitious name of an essay in social philosophy. But whatever the name, the essential point remains that all I shall have to say is derived from certain ultimate values. I hope I have adequately discharged in the book itself a second and no less important duty, to make it clear beyond doubt what these ultimate values are on which the whole argument depends. There is, however, one thing I want to add to this. Though this is a political book, I am as certain as anyone can be that the beliefs set out in it are not determined by my personal interests, I can discover no reason why the kind of society which seems to me desirable should offer greater advantages to me than to the great majority of the people of my country. In fact, I am always told by my socialist colleagues that, as an economist, I should occupy a much more important position in the kind of society to which I am opposed, provided, of course, that I could bring myself to accept their views. I feel equally certain that my opposition to these views is not due to their being different from those with which I have grown up, since they are the very views which I held as a young man, and which have led me to make the study of economics my profession. For those who, in the current fashion, seek interested motives in every profession of a political opinion, I may, perhaps, be allowed to add that I have every possible reason for not writing or publishing this book. It is certain to offend many people with whom I wish to live on friendly terms. It has forced me to put aside work for which I feel better qualified, and to which I attach greater importance in the long run. And above all, it is certain to prejudice the reception of the results of the more strictly academic work to which all my inclinations lead me. If, in spite of this, I have come to regard the writing of this book as a duty which I must not evade, this was mainly due to a peculiar and serious feature of the discussions of problems of future economic policy at the present time, of which the public is scarcely sufficiently aware. This is the fact that the majority of economists have now for some years been absorbed by the war machine and silenced by their official positions, and that, in consequence, public opinion on these problems is to an alarming extent guided by amateurs and cranks, by people who have an axe to grind or a pet panacea to sell. In these circumstances, one who still has the leisure for literary work is hardly entitled to keep to himself apprehensions which current tendencies must create in the minds of many who cannot publicly express them. Though in different circumstances, I should have gladly left the discussion of questions of national policy to those who are both better authorized and better qualified for the task. The central argument of this book was first sketched in an article entitled Freedom and the Economic System, which appeared in the Contemporary Review for April 1938 and was later reprinted in an enlarged form as one of the public policy pamphlets edited by Professor H. D. Giddeans for the University of Chicago Press, 1939. I have to thank the editors and publishers of both these publications for permission to reproduce certain passages from them. F. A. Hayek. Forward to the 1956 American paperback edition. Although this book might in some respects have been different if I had written it in the first instance with American readers primarily in mind, it has by now made for itself too definite, if unexpected, a place in this country to make any rewriting advisable. Its republication in a new form, however, more than 10 years after its first appearance, is perhaps an appropriate occasion for explaining its original aim and for a few comments on the altogether unforeseen and in many ways curious success it has had in this country. The book was written in England during the war years and was designed almost exclusively for English readers. Indeed, it was addressed mainly to a very special class of readers in England. It was in no spirit of mockery that I dedicated it to the socialists of all parties. It had its origin in many discussions which, during the preceding 10 years, I had with friends and colleagues whose sympathies had been inclined toward the left, and it was in continuation of those arguments that I wrote The Road to Serfdom. When Hitler came into power in Germany, I had already been teaching at the University of London for several years, but I kept in close touch with affairs on the continent, and was able to do so until the outbreak of war. What I had thus seen of the origins and evolution of the various totalitarian movements made me feel that English public opinion, particularly among my friends who held advanced views on social matters, completely misconceived the nature of those movements. Even before the war, I was led by this to state in a brief essay what became the central argument of this book. But after war broke out, I felt that this widespread misunderstanding of the political systems of our enemies, and soon also of our new ally, Russia, constituted a serious danger which had to be met by a more systematic effort. Also, it was already fairly obvious that England herself was likely to experiment after the war with the same kind of policies which I was convinced had contributed so much to destroy liberty elsewhere. Thus, this book gradually took shape as a warning to the socialist intelligentsia of England. With the inevitable delays of wartime production, it finally appeared there early in the spring of 1944. This date will, incidentally, also explain why I felt that in order to get a hearing, I had somewhat to restrain myself in my comments on the regime of our wartime ally, and to choose my illustrations mainly from developments in Germany. It seems that the book appeared at a propitious moment, and I can feel only gratification at the success it had in England, which, though very different in kind, was quantitatively no smaller than it was to be in the United States. On the whole, the book was taken in the spirit in which it was written, and its argument was seriously examined by those to whom it was mainly addressed, excepting only certain of the leading politicians of the Labour Party, who, as if to provide an illustration for my remarks on the nationalist tendencies of socialism, attacked the book on the ground that it was written by a foreigner, the thoughtful and receptive manner in which it was generally examined by persons who must have found its conclusions running counter to their strongest convictions was deeply impressive. The most representative example of British criticism of the book from a left-wing point of view is probably Mrs. Barbara Wooten's courteous and frank study, Freedom Under Planning, London, George Allen and Unwin, 1946. It is often quoted in the United States as an effective refutation of my argument, though I cannot help feeling that more than one reader must have gained the impression that, as one American reviewer expressed it, it seems substantially to confirm Hayek's thesis. Chester I. Barnard, Southern Economic Journal, January, 1946. The same applies also to the other European countries where the book eventually appeared, and its particularly cordial reception by the post-Nazi generation of Germany. When copies of a translation published in Switzerland at last reached that country, was one of the unforeseen pleasures I derived from its publication. Rather different was the reception the book had in the United States when it was published here a few months after its appearance in England. I had given little thought to its possible appeal to American readers when writing it. It was then 20 years since I had last been in America as a research student, and during that time I had somewhat lost touch with the development of American ideas. I could not be sure how far my argument had direct relevance to the American scene, and I was not in the least surprised when the book was, in fact, rejected by the first three publishing houses approached. I did not know then, as has since been admitted by a person advising one of the firms, that this appears to have been due not to any doubts of the success of the book, but to political prejudice, which went to the extent of representing the book as unfit for publication by a reputable house. See on this the statement by William Miller, quoted by W. T. Couch in The Sainted Book Burners, The Freeman, April 1955, page 423, and also William Miller, The Book Industry, a report of the Public Library Inquiry of the Social Science Research Council, New York, Columbia University Press, 1949, page 12. It was certainly most unexpected when, after the book was brought out by its present publishers, it soon began to sell at a rate almost unprecedented for a book of this kind, not intended for popular consumption. Not a little of this was due to the publication of a condensation of this book in the Reader's Digest, and I should like to pay here to the editors of this journal a public testimony to the extremely skillful manner in which this was done without my assistance. It is inevitable that the compression of a complex argument to a fraction of its original length produces some oversimplification, but that it was done without distortion, and better than I could have done it myself, is a remarkable achievement. And I was even more surprised by the violence of the reaction from both political wings, by the lavish praise the book received from some quarters, no less than by the passionate hatred it appeared to arouse in others. Contrary to my experience in England, In America, the kind of people to whom this book was mainly addressed seem to have rejected it out of hand as a malicious and disingenuous attack on their finest ideals. They appear never to have paused to examine its argument. The language used and the emotion shown in some of the more adverse criticism the book received were indeed rather extraordinary. To any reader who would like to see a specimen of abuse and invective, which is probably unique in contemporary academic discussion, I recommend a reading of Professor Herman Feiner's Road to Reaction, Boston, Little Brown and Company, 1945. But scarcely less surprising to me was the enthusiastic welcome accorded to the book by many whom I never expected to read a volume of this type, and from many more of whom I still doubt whether, in fact, they ever read it. And I must add that occasionally, the manner in which it was used vividly brought home to me the truth of Lord Acton's observation that, at all times, sincere friends of freedom have been rare, and its triumphs have been due to minorities that have prevailed by associating themselves with auxiliaries, whose objects often differed from their own, and this association, which is always dangerous, has sometimes been disastrous. It seems hardly likely that this extraordinary difference in the reception of the book on the two sides of the Atlantic is due entirely to a difference in national temperament. I have since become increasingly convinced that the explanation must lie in a difference of intellectual situation at the time when it arrived. In England, and in Europe generally, the problems with which I dealt had long ceased to be abstract questions. The ideals which I examined had long before come down to earth, and even their most enthusiastic adherents had already seen concretely some of the difficulties and unlooked-for results which their application produced. I was thus writing about phenomena of which almost all my European readers had some more or less close experience, and I was merely arguing systematically and consistently what many had already intuitively felt. There was already a disillusionment about these ideals underway, which their critical examination merely made more vocal or explicit. In the United States, on the other hand, these ideals were still fresh and more virulent. It was only 10 or 15 years earlier, not 40 or 50 as in England, that a large part of the intelligentsia had caught the infection, and, in spite of the experimentation of the New Deal, their enthusiasm for the new kind of rationally constructed society was still largely unsoiled by practical experience. What, to most Europeans, had in some measure become vieux jeu was, to the American radicals, still the glittering hope of a better world which they had embraced and nourished during the recent years of the Great Depression. Opinion moves fast in the United States, and even now, it is difficult to remember how comparatively short a time it was before the road to serfdom appeared that the most extreme kind of economic planning had been seriously advocated, and the model of Russia held up for imitation by men who were soon to play an important role in public affairs. It would be easy enough to give chapter and verse for this, but it would be invidious now to single out individuals. Be it enough to mention that in 1934, the newly established National Planning Board devoted a good deal of attention to the example of planning provided by these four countries, Germany, Italy, Russia, and Japan. 10 years later, we had, of course, learned to refer to these same countries as totalitarian, had fought a long war with three of them, and were soon to start a cold war with the fourth. Yet the contention of this book that the political development in those countries had something to do with their economic policies was then still indignantly rejected by the advocates of planning in this country. It suddenly became the fashion to deny that the inspiration of planning had come from Russia, and to contend, as one of my eminent critics put it, that it was a plain fact that Italy, Russia, Japan, and Germany all reached totalitarianism by very different roads. The whole intellectual climate in the United States at the time the road to serfdom appeared was thus one in which it was bound either profoundly to shock or greatly to delight the members of sharply divided groups. In consequence, in spite of its apparent success, The book has not had here the kind of effect I should have wished, or which it has had elsewhere. It is true that its main conclusions are today widely accepted. If 12 years ago it seemed to many almost sacrilege to suggest that fascism and communism are merely variants of the same totalitarianism which central control of all economic activity tends to produce, this has become almost a commonplace. It is now even widely recognized that democratic socialism is a very precarious and unstable affair, ridden with internal contradictions, and everywhere producing results most distasteful to many of its advocates. For this sobered mood, the lessons of events and more popular discussions of the problem are certainly more responsible than this book. The most effective of these was undoubtedly George Orwell's 1984. The author had earlier kindly reviewed this book. Nor was my general thesis as such original when it was published. Although similar but earlier warnings may have been largely forgotten, the dangers inherent in the policies which I criticized had been pointed out again and again. Whatever merits this book possesses consist not in the reiteration of this thesis, but in the patient and detailed examination of the reasons why economic planning will produce such unlooked-for results, and of the process by which they come about. It is for this reason that I rather hope that the time may now be more favorable in America for a serious consideration of the true argument of the book than it was when it first appeared. I believe that what is important in it still has to render its service, although I recognize that the hot socialism against which it was mainly directed, that organized movement toward a deliberate organization of economic life by the state as the chief owner of the means of production, is nearly dead in the Western world. The century of socialism, in this sense, probably came to an end around 1948. Many of its illusions have been discarded even by its leaders, and elsewhere, as well as in the United States, the very name has lost much of its attraction. Attempts will no doubt be made to rescue the name for movements which are less dogmatic, less doctrinaire, and less systematic. But an argument applicable solely against those clear-cut conceptions of social reform which characterized the socialist movements of the past might today well appear as tilting against windmills. Yet, though hot socialism is probably a thing of the past, some of its conceptions have penetrated far too deeply into the whole structure of current thought to justify complacency. If few people in the Western world now want to remake society from the bottom, according to some ideal blueprint, a great many still believe in measures which, though not designed completely to remodel the economy, in their aggregate effect may well unintentionally produce this result. And, even more than at the time when I wrote this book, the advocacy of policies which, in the long run, cannot be reconciled with the preservation of a free society is no longer a party matter. That hodgepodge of ill-assembled and often inconsistent ideals which, under the name of the welfare state, has largely replaced socialism as the goal of the reformers, needs very careful sorting out if its results are not to be very similar to those of full-fledged socialism. This is not to say that some of its aims are not both practicable and laudable, but there are many ways in which we can work toward the same goal, and in the present state of opinion, there is some danger that our impatience for quick results may lead us to choose instruments which, though perhaps more efficient for achieving the particular ends, are not compatible with the preservation of a free society. The increasing tendency to rely on administrative coercion and discrimination where a modification of the general rules of law might, perhaps more slowly, achieve the same object, and to resort to direct state controls, or to the creation of monopolistic institutions where judicious use of financial inducements might evoke spontaneous efforts, is still a powerful legacy of the socialist period which is likely to influence policy for a long time to come. Just because in the years ahead of us, political ideology is not likely to aim at a clearly defined goal but toward piecemeal change, a full understanding of the process through which certain kinds of measures can destroy the bases of an economy based on the market and gradually smother the creative powers of a free civilization seems now of the greatest importance. Only if we understand why and how certain kinds of economic controls tend to paralyze the driving forces of a free society, and which kinds of measures are particularly dangerous in this respect, can we hope that social experimentation will not lead us into situations none of us want. It is as a contribution to this task that this book is intended. I hope that, at least in the quieter atmosphere of the present, it will be received as what it was meant to be. Not as an exhortation to resistance against any improvement or experimentation, but as a warning that we should insist that any modification in our arrangements should pass certain tests described in the central chapter on the rule of law, before we commit ourselves to courses from which withdrawal may be difficult. The fact that this book was originally written with only the British public in mind does not appear to have seriously affected its intelligibility for the American reader. But there is one point of phraseology which I ought to explain here to forestall any misunderstanding. I use throughout the term liberal in the original 19th century sense in which it is still current in Britain. In current American usage, it often means very nearly the opposite of this. It has been part of the camouflage of leftish movements in this country, helped by the muddle-headedness of many who really believe in liberty, that liberal has come to mean the advocacy of almost every kind of government control. I am still puzzled why those in the United States who truly believe in liberty should not only have allowed the left to appropriate this almost indispensable term, but should even have assisted by beginning to use it themselves as a term of opprobrium. This seems to be particularly regrettable because of the consequent tendency of many true liberals to describe themselves as conservatives. It is true, of course, that in the struggle against the believers in the all-powerful state, the true liberal must sometimes make common cause with the conservative. And in some circumstances, as in contemporary Britain, he has hardly any other way of actively working for his ideals. But true liberalism is still distinct from conservatism, and there is danger in the two being confused. Conservatism, though a necessary element in any stable society, is not a social program. In its paternalistic, nationalistic, and power-adoring tendencies, it is often closer to socialism than true liberalism, and with its traditionalistic, anti-intellectual, and often mystical propensities, it will never, except in short periods of disillusionment, appeal to the young and all those others who believe that some changes are desirable if this world is to become a better place. A conservative movement, by its very nature, is bound to be a defender of established privilege, and to lean on the power of government for the protection of privilege. The essence of the liberal position, however, is the denial of all privilege, if privilege is understood in its proper and original meaning of the state granting and protecting rights to some, which are not available on equal terms to others. Perhaps a further word of apology is required for my allowing this book to reappear in entirely unchanged form after the lapse of almost 12 years. I have many times tried to revise it, and there are numerous points I should like to explain at greater length, or to state more cautiously, or to fortify by more illustration and proof. But all attempts at rewriting only proved that I could never again produce as short a book covering as much of the field, and it seems to me that whatever other merits it may have, its relative brevity is its greatest. I have thus been forced to the conclusion that, whenever I want to add to the argument, I must attempt in separate studies. I have begun to do so in various essays, some of which provide a more searching discussion of certain philosophical and economic issues on which the present book only touches. Individualism and Economic Order, Chicago, 1948. On the special question of the roots of the ideas here criticized, and of their connection with some of the most powerful and impressive intellectual movements of this age, I have commented in another volume. The Counter-Revolution of Science, Glencoe, Illinois, 1952. And before long, I hope to supplement the all-too-brief central chapter of this book by a more extensive treatment of the relation between equality and justice. An advanced sketch of my treatment of this subject has been published by the National Bank of Egypt in the form of 4 lectures on The Political Ideal of the Rule of Law, Cairo, 1955. There is one particular topic, however, on which the reader will with justice expect me to comment on this occasion, yet which I could even less treat adequately without writing a new book. Little more than a year after The Road to Serfdom first appeared, Great Britain had a socialist government, which remained in power for 6 years. And the question of how far this experience has confirmed or refuted my apprehensions is one which I must try to answer at least briefly. If anything, this experience has strengthened my concern and, I believe I may add, has taught the reality of the difficulties I pointed out to many for whom an abstract argument would never have carried conviction. Indeed, it was not long after the Labour government came into power that some of the issues which my critics in America dismissed as bogies became, in Great Britain, main topics of political discussion. Soon, even official documents were gravely discussing the danger of totalitarianism raised by the policy of economic planning. There is no better illustration of the manner in which the inherent logic of their policies drove an unwilling socialist government into the kind of coercion it disliked, than the following passage in Economic Survey for 1947, which the Prime Minister presented to Parliament in February of that year, and its sequel. There is an essential difference between totalitarian and democratic planning. The former subordinates all individual desires and preferences to the demand of the state. For this purpose, it uses various methods of compulsion upon the individual, which deprive him of his freedom of choice. Such methods may be necessary even in a democratic country during the extreme emergency of a great war. Thus, the British people gave their wartime government the power to direct labor. But in normal times, the people of a democratic country will not give up their freedom of choice to their government. A democratic government must, therefore, conduct its economic planning in a manner which preserves the maximum possible freedom of choice to the individual citizen. The interesting point about this profession of laudable intentions is that 6 months later, the same government found itself in peacetime forced to put the conscription of labor back on the statute book. It hardly diminishes the significance of this when it is pointed out that the power was in fact never used, because if it is known that the authorities have power to coerce, few will wait for actual coercion. But it is rather difficult to see how the government could have persisted in its illusions when in the same document it claims that it was now for the government to say what is the best use for the resources in the national interest, and to lay down the economic task for the nation, it must say which things are the most important and what the objectives of policy ought to be. Of course, 6 years of socialist government in England have not produced anything resembling a totalitarian state. But those who argue that this has disproved the thesis of The Road to Serfdom have really missed one of its main points, that the most important change which extensive government control produces is a psychological change, an alteration in the character of the people. This is necessarily a slow affair, a process which extends not over a few years, but perhaps over 1 or 2 generations. The important point is that the political ideals of a people and its attitude toward authority are as much the effect as the cause of the political institutions under which it lives. This means, among other things, that even a strong tradition of political liberty is no safeguard if the danger is precisely that new institutions and policies will gradually undermine and destroy that spirit. The consequences can, of course, be averted if that spirit reasserts itself in time, and the people not only throw out the party which has been leading them further and further in the dangerous direction, but also recognize the nature of the danger and resolutely change their course. There is not yet much ground to believe that the latter has happened in England. Yet the change undergone by the character of the British people, not merely under its Labour government, but in the course of the much longer period during which it has been enjoying the blessings of a paternalistic welfare state, can hardly be mistaken. These changes are not easily demonstrated, but are clearly felt if one lives in the country. In illustration, I will cite a few significant passages from a sociological survey dealing with the impact of the surfeit of regulation on the mental attitudes of the young. It is concerned with the situation before the Labour government came into power. In fact,